welcome to Season 7, Episode 9 of Unlimited Opinions. I'm Adam Bishop.
I'm Mark Bishop.
We are, of course, reading Peter Kreeft's A Refutation of Moral Relativism, Interviews with an Absolutist, this time talking about Interview 9, The Arguments for Moral Absolutism. So we've kind of looked in the past at some of the arguments in favor of moral relativism. We have, like, the absolutist character refuting those. Now he's putting forward his own arguments here. He has several of them. I think it was 5 total that he kind of went through pretty quickly here. What do you think of this chapter?
Good. You know, it's a good read. You know, if you're looking for a real detailed argument in favor of moral absolutism, I don't think this is really the book. You know, it's a way to quickly explain the point of view. But, you know, he has 7 arguments for moral absolutism in this chapter in under 15 pages.
Yeah.
So just put that in perspective to anybody who's thinking about getting the book. You know, there are, you know, it's more of a cursory argument, I think.
I think so. And I think this chapter was a little bit more, what'd you say?
It was effective.
Yeah. Yes. No, I think this chapter was a little bit more repetitive than past chapters. I feel like, you know, for the past, all the chapters before this, there was some new spin being put on it. But I feel like this chapter, more than the others, felt a little bit more like a rehash of stuff that we've already heard. But I mean, it's still well written. It was still, you know, effective, like you said, but I think it was didn't provide as much new information that we as much as we got like in the past few chapters.
True. And it was more of a like a restatement.
Yeah.
Of past arguments with a little bit more, you know, fleshing some of it out a little bit. Mm-hmm. So let's get into it. So, you know, there's obviously back and forth, which is it's a good read. It's a fun read because you kind of get. It's not only, you know, the topic that we care about is moral absolutism and moral relativism, but it's also kind of it's well written in that there's, you kind of get to know the characters a little bit, you know, the fictional characters are having this debate or this interview or whatever it's going to be, depending on the chapter. And I enjoy that, you know, because they're consistent throughout the book. You know, you would expect them to make these, and there's a sides that we don't really get into. So I do like how it's written. Anyway, so the 7 arguments are very quickly stated, you know, the topics of the argument, I guess you'd say, 136 of the book, and we're, you know, quickly approaching the end, I think. Anyway, are arguments from consequences, like the consequences of the philosophy, from consensus, arguments from experience. From a moral argument, and arguments from moral language, which I thought you'd be more interested in than some, which was really brief. The self-contradiction argument, which I think is just, they just said, yeah, we already mentioned that. I don't even think they even talked about it, if I remember correctly. And then the self-contradiction argument. So there's 7, but they really only talk about, I think, 5, really, in any sort of detail. So the first one is from consequences. So this is I think it was mentioned in previous chapters. It's the argument that is, okay, all right, well, when you have moral relativism, it's really more like, he's more like trying to refute relativism in this chapter. He is arguing for absolutism, but I guess if it's a zero-sum argument in the way it's framed, because a lot of times he's just saying, well, you know, it's better than moral relativism because, you know, ideas have consequences, as he says in this chapter. We should evaluate ideas by their practical consequences. And then he doesn't really talk about the benefits, so to speak, of moral absolutism. He really just poops on the consequences of moral relativism.
Which is, I think, why it's very similar to the past chapters, because that was a very similar reasoning to when he was refuting the arguments for relativism that Libby, the relativist character, proposed. So I feel like it's somewhat of the same argument that he's just running through here.
Yes. Agreed. Yeah. Because he doesn't actually put forth an affirmative. Okay. Because you could just have, well, we're just not going to even talk about morality. We're just going to talk about, you know, a utility argument or, you know, what is the best practical, but a lot of that's moral relativism, But you know, you can just say, okay, we're just going to have these rules, whether they're from God or not. But these are the rules that we're all going to follow. Maybe a vote on them every 10 years or something. Well, that's not a moral absolutist position. That is an absolute position on what are the rules that we're going to follow. You know, I mean, but in a sense, it's a moral structure. It's really more an ethical structure. And then you could change them every 10 years, you know, but you can have them set in stone legally. Okay, we're going to say, you know, you can't kill unless it's under these circumstances, but we're all going to vote. And everybody agrees now, but in 10 years, we're going to look at it again. Mm-hmm. So that's not, I don't really consider that moral absolutism.
Yeah.
But I just don't think there's any arguments about, okay, why do we have to have, or why should we have? Mm-hmm. Well, really, I guess the argument is, why do we have to have moral absolutism? And we kind of, he doesn't make that case, but he does. Yeah. I mean, I do like how he poops on the moral relativism. And again, you know, kind of expands on this argument mm-hmm. that the relativists aren't tolerant mm-hmm. of opinions or persons. They're just tolerant of evil.
Yeah. I do like what he says before that, because he asks Libby, the relativist character, you know, what is the consequence of moral relativism? She says tolerance. He agrees with her, but he says, he pulls a quote from Chesterton. He said that tolerance is the one value you have left when you've lost all your principles. If you want to do bad things, you tolerate them in others so that at least you're not a hypocrite. And so he says, well, yeah, of course, relativism leads to tolerance. And he says tolerance of evil, just so you don't feel like a hypocrite. You're going to tolerate all of these evil things so you yourself don't feel bad. You don't feel like a hypocrite for the things that you're doing.
Right. Right. And that's really the gist of his argument. But it's not really an argument for absolutism again. So, yeah, he talks about but he does talk about, you know, the consequences of a moral relativism is the removal of deterrence. Moral mm-hmm. absolutism. He does make this case. It does make it sets absolute rules and principles by which you evaluate, you know, specific circumstances. So in the consequences of that are you have a consistent moral philosophy for everybody, as opposed mm-hmm. to just you're just arguing over stuff all the time. And he mentions, well, you know, the sinners and saints discussion where, you know, she says, well, aren't all saints sinners? And he says, yeah, but no saints are relativists, you know, mm-hmm. truly saintly people, really good people. You know, the people that we admire and respect are moral absolutists. You're not mm-hmm. relativists. They're not saying, oh, you can do whatever you want, but I kind of chose a good path. No, they all had a fundamental belief that what they were doing was necessary and right, and would share that with others. So I think, and then he talks, I think he talks in this here at this point, that the society functions better. Mm-hmm. You know, not only is it better for the individual, but for the society, you know, all through time, you know, human history, the quality of life is better. The longevity, you know, people lived longer and they had more stability and peace when you had rulers in a society, especially that had certain moral absolutist, whatever those absolutist policies or philosophies are. And then he mentions, you know, if you have moral relativists, you have murderous, lying, horrible leaders in society, and it's short lived. Mm-hmm. And she says, well, there's not that many of them. He says, well, that's true. It's a relatively new philosophy, but you know, you got Chairman Mao. And you got Mussolini as examples, who were really moral relativists. Now, Mao, I would say, well, I guess you'd say he had situational ethics. Whatever situation benefited him was fine, mm-hmm. especially if he could kill people and divorce his wife or marry a new wife. Mm-hmm. I'm plowing through a biography of Mao right now. Mm. And it's hard for me to read. So it's a really good book, but it's hard to read because I keep rooting for other characters, even other communists, to figure out, man, you got to kill this guy. He's going to kill you. Do you know that he is planning to kill you? You should kill him now. Don't wait. You have the opportunity. There's a whole bunch of opportunities early on mm-hmm. when they were struggling between them and the nationalists run by Chiang Kai-shek. At the same time that Japan has invaded China, mm-hmm. Russia's meddling in there and funding, you know, the communists, and Mao is undercutting, and he's just such a terrible person. Anyway, so, but he was a moral relativist, but I don't know that he did anything on a moral code. It was just whatever benefited him.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's like the Beatles said, you know, if you go around carrying pictures of Chairman Mao, you're not going to make it with anyone anyhow. So there you go.
True.
They're wise beyond their years.
Yes.
That's my quote of wisdom for the day.
I think, wasn't that after they had gone to that yogi in India or Pakistan or something, or yeah. The Buddhas, wherever.
That was the song Revolution, which was on, I think, the White Album originally was released as a single. They had a couple different recordings of it. So it would have been like 68. So it would have been in their like Hindu phase. Yeah.
But I think if I remember correctly, that was written around the time where they realized they were being misled. Mm. You know, this guy was just because they went in for it. And it sounds great at first, but then you realize this guy's just doing this to get chicks. He's just trying to get underage girls. That's exactly what he was doing. Which is like what they all do.
Yeah.
Golly.
Well, more relativists.
Yes. I was about to go on a funny and inappropriate rant, and I restrained myself.
I'm almost disappointed.
Well, you're not underage, but you know, you're my son, so let's not go that direction. So the second argument, it was really kind of very similar to the first one, mm-hmm. I thought, which argument was
from consensus. Yeah.
Yeah. The consensus. Well, everybody kind of agrees over time of human history that this is the case. You know, if you look over time in all societies, they had some sort of, this is our belief system. And if you don't believe in that system, then we're going to have to kill you. Mm-hmm. You know, burn them at the stake or whatever. And who was I was just reading about that? I was like, oh yeah, was it Thomas More? Yeah, St. Thomas More. So I joined the St. Thomas More Society. There's a legal society or whatever. And I was trying to remind myself, okay, he's a King Henry VIII guy, right? Because he wouldn't sign off on, I think it was a marriage annulment, if I remember correctly, and then a new marriage to a new gal. And but he didn't actually oppose it. He was just like, okay, I gotta quit. And he couldn't even do that. So he kind of wasn't really the paragon of bravery or virtue at the beginning, but then he stuck to it. He's like, no, I'm just not gonna do it. And
he's got a great quote though. Great final words. The I remain the king's good servant, but God's first.
Yes. And I think that's a okay quote, but screw that guy. I mean, why would you say I'm his servant? You know what? F you. You know, you and your dirty whore wife. You know, why wouldn't you say that? You philandering, lying, murderous jackass. I'm God's servant. F you. Cut off my head. Whatever you're going to do. I don't know who Victor Davis Hanson got this quote from, but he's quoting somebody and I'm too lazy to look it up. But he says, you know, at some point we have to say, you do your worst and I'll do my best and we'll see how it all works out. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a good life philosophy, you know, especially in politics and stuff, mm-hmm. Or debates about morality. And you say you do your worst, I'll do my best. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, and then everything will sort out one way or the other and we'll just both have to live with it. And I think that's a better quote. But anyways, so how did I get on there?
I don't know. But I do like the point that he makes in here, talking about the consensus, is to be a relativist, you have to be a snob because you have to believe that nearly all of the human beings who have ever lived in this world, especially the greatest sages and saints and prophets, they have all based their lives on an illusion, a fantasy, a myth. And that's one of my biggest problems, I think, with like the modern idea of, you know, progress above all else, is like people just inherently think that they and everything about society is better now just because it's happening now and not happening 800 years ago. And it's like, well, we automatically think that we are just infinitely superior to all of these. I think he even gives Libby he calls people savages, or she does, but 2 billion savages can't be wrong. And I think that's a pretty common idea that people think that anybody that came before us is just a stupid savage that don't have the ideas of science and medicine and technology that we have now. And they were just fundamentally wrong about everything. And I think it is a byproduct of that relativism, the very self-centeredness, the very selfishness there.
True. I guess I was talking about consensus somehow, but anyway,
yes, I don't know.
Those are good points. Thanks for redirecting me.
You're welcome.
I like how he, you know, to this consensus argument, he mentions, you know, like all throughout time, as you mentioned, you know, all these people were absolutists, but he mentions that, you know, as a percentage of humans, moral relativists are a minority almost totally concentrated in one civilization, the modern West, which I think is pretty much true. And then he calls it apostate Christianity, apostate Christendom. And I think that's really true. You know, it's only in our areas, really, that this is where people just fell away from the church or ran away from the church, as the case may be. And that's really where this philosophy has taken hold with the people in power. And I think you're 100% right, is the arrogance and the fact that they're parents and grandparents and great grandparents were so successful as moral absolutists in creating this society of wealth and leisure. And they don't realize, well, that's a part of the mix.
Yeah.
You know, it's not just, hey, these are really smart scientists that came up with the television and the remote control mass production of food. But, you know, they had a moral philosophy that made all that possible, you know, and I didn't do that. But he, and she does mention, which is, I was waiting for the counter argument, which you just mentioned, like, you know, 2 billion savages can't be wrong argument, which is making light of the fact that this, we don't vote on this.
Yeah. You know, and I do like how he addresses that a little bit, because she says, you know, you're telling the truth. Are you telling the truth by counting noses now? He says, no, it's only a probable argument. And I think that's an important thing to include. This does not prove it's automatically correct. Yeah. But he's saying, well, I'm putting it in your terms. You know, it should appeal to egalitarians like you who argue against absolutism because you say it's connected with snobbery. And then he quotes, you know, Chesterton as, you know, defining, you know, tradition as the extension of egalitarianism to the past, calling it the extension of the franchise to vote to people who are disenfranchised, not by accident of birth, but by accident of death. And so having that like egalitarian mindset. And I really like that quote from Chesterton there. But I think it's important to differentiate that just because more people have believed it doesn't automatically make it true. But we should acknowledge that, you know, this is a thing that tradition has proved true in some ways, and we should respect that.
Yes. Well, it goes back to the old argument between a conservative and a liberal when they come up, or, you know, a leftist or whatever, when they come upon a fence in a field. The liberal wants to, we need to tear down these barriers and have freedom, blah, blah, blah. And the conservative says, well, you know what? We need to find out why this fence was built in the first place.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
You know, it might be keeping us out of danger, or it could be keeping danger away from us.
Mm-hmm.
So let's find out why first. Is that thinking of, okay, the wisdom of the past, they may have good reason, you know, for all this stuff and these beliefs. Mm-hmm. So, but, you know, it's not something that proves that they were right. It's just, you ought to consider it. And, you know, maybe there's a probability that it's right if everybody agrees to it over time. And we have had a lot of progress. I think that's a really good argument for Christianity, quite frankly. Because if you look historically, what is the really the big boom in truth and justice, scientific endeavors, and coming out of famine and all that stuff? It's a combination of Christian ideals, true Christian ideals, and the free market system, which they kind of melded together eventually into a regulated capitalist society with underlying belief in the Ten Commandments, plus Jesus's philosophy of forgiveness and love. And I think that's a very powerful combination.
Mm-hmm.
You don't see that kind of really blossoming in any other religious era.
Mm-hmm.
I guess you could argue about some of the Asian countries, I guess. But you know, like Judaism, of course, everybody wants to kill the Jews, evidently. So that kind of inhibits their growth. You know, like, what? Of course, they ever wanted to kill the Christians too, or at least a lot of Roman Empire, and they're like, "Oh yeah, well, we'd like to, for you to kill us."
Well, what? I think that goes back to the idea about the apostate Christendom too. Is like the only places where we see that people have enough leisure and free time and nothing better to do than to think about moral relativism is coming to these places where it was formerly Christian. Now they're, you know, some of the richest countries and the most democratic countries in the world, and so now you have the ability to think about these things that make no sense now that we've thrown off the label of Christianity.
Yeah. And I like at the end of this argument, this is the second one, right? Where you mentioned, you know, the Chesterton quote, and there's another quote, I think, from Chesterton too, but then they talk about, you know, history and moral ignorance and that kind of stuff. And he speaks up for medieval philosophers.
Mm-hmm.
And that's refreshing to see in a book, because, you know, they, all of them, whether they're Jewish, Christian, or Muslim, in that era, they were, as he says, they were rational to a fault, while most modern philosophers since the Enlightenment have been attacked reason in like every other direction. I'm on 1.2 at this point. And then, you know, for the, almost the whole Western philosophy for the last two centuries has been an attack on reason. And maybe I do need to go into academia and start publishing my own philosophy. Now that I can breathe, this sinus surgery, I've got like the mental energy of two of me from like a month ago. So watch out, people.
That's a dangerous idea.
I'm going to be on the march. It's like the same ideas, but like faster, and I can hold the thought longer. Watch out. We gotta share the good news.
Oh boy, that's a scary thought.
And so I thought I'd like that, and then he flows into, unless you have comments in there, it flows into the third argument, which is the argument from data, from moral experience. That was, he already said, he already talked about that. We didn't
There's a whole chapter dedicated to that. So
he says, okay, we're gonna talk about that. So let's move on to the fourth one, and that's the moral language one, which I thought was really the strongest argument, the strongest argument against relativists, because he's basically saying, you know, listen to what you guys say. You're one of us. Mm-hmm. You know, he's not saying necessarily we're right. The moral absolutes are right. He's just saying, look at your language. If we're arguing about morality, even relativist quarrel, we don't just fight about our feelings, you know, how does this affect me or how it affects you? We fight over what is right and what is wrong. And he says, you know, that if you believe there's a right and wrong, then it shows you believe in an absolute moral code, whatever that is. And he says in the middle of 143, if relativism were true, moral arguments would be impossible. We'd just be arguing about feelings. You know, you're wrong, I'm right. You know, I feel that you're wrong. I feel that you're right. And you argue about all this stuff, but you couldn't acknowledge that there's anything that's true.
Because that goes back, to her earlier arguments, because she was saying, you know, there's really no, you know, objective morality. It's just our own feelings about things. So if that's true, we wouldn't even be able to say, like he says, you're wrong. No, I'm right. He's saying, you know, if you really believed in that ideology that there is no absolute morality, you would just say, well, I feel lousy about that. No, I feel fine about it. It would just be opinion judgments. Just be, no, this is my opinion about things. But of course, we don't talk like that. You know, we have our language because we have an understanding of a moral truth. There's something higher than, you know, ourselves and higher than like the words we say that we're calling upon when we use language. And so there must be some sort of moral absolutes. And we all believe that. And so it's reflected in our language.
Yeah, and it is reflected in the language of the moral relativists. You know, that's the whole point. Mm-hmm. It shows the need for universal, objective, unchanging principles. We can't have, and without that, we can't have any moral arguments at all, as he says in 44. And it's just really true. And they talk about, you know, what I really like is this little exchange. It's kind of an aside where they're talking about, you know, his arguments versus her arguments. And he's like, well, if it's true, it's, you know, arguments, he says, arguments are not private property like warts. They're public proofs. It's like science. And if it's true, if everything proved to be true is true, you know, that is, and whenever you debate or you discuss these things with a relativist or modern leftist, you have to at first establish that fact that everything proved to be true is true. And it's just so weird that there's so many people in media and have a following will not accept that.
Yeah.
It's proved to be true. It's true, period. And if you're proved to be wrong, you're wrong. And you're always wrong about that. You know, change your mind. But if you keep saying the wrong stuff, you're still wrong. It's not just there's no my truth.
Yeah.
Unless you prove it. If you prove it, then it's our truth. You know, there is no my truth. It's our truth. I keep telling the story about that judge who I show case law. I said, judge, this case says you got to rule this way. You have to rule the way that I want you to rule. And she says, I don't need your law, Mr. Bishop. I said, it's not my law. My law. I'm being like overly dramatic. Well, I thought it was everybody's law. It's your law. It's my law. It's their law. It's everybody's law. Thankfully, she had a good sense of humor, and she knew I wasn't just mocking her. She, that's enough out of you, Mr. Bishop, with a smile.
That's funny.
I'm ruling against you, so I understand that, but don't tell me it's not your law. Your law is.
Well, that's sort of the
her law was, I'm the judge, and you lose.
Well, that's sort of the argument I made. I ended up writing that essay for the ISI scholarship I think I was telling you about last week about, you know, the importance of liberal education and stuff. That was essentially my main argument is, you know, I pulled a quote from Newman, St. Newman, about, you know, how liberal education is designed to provide students like an idea of the truth in all of its branches. So you get, you know, an idea of the truth. Yeah. And so the argument that I was making throughout is that essentially what the modern education system does is it removes any sense of like the core truth. You know, we don't have that. We can't really talk about the purpose of things. It's just explaining, go, here's what something is, here's where it came from. That's the information they're giving to people. And they're encouraging students not to use that information to look at the truth, but to use that information, their perspectives, to go out and make their own truth. And that's really the problem. It's a completely backward system. Instead of using perspectives of the truth, you're using perspectives and these facts and whatever to go out and build something new instead of connecting it to the source. And so it's completely disassociated from, you know, whatever came before. And it's just this entirely different thing that we and that's why we can't agree on anything. That's why society, you know, that's why liberal education is so important for a free society, because we all have our own conceptions of the truth that are entirely different from one another. We can't agree on anything. And it's like the author says, you know, many times throughout here, that if we don't have any common ground, then the only way we can prove our arguments is by force, by forcing them onto people. There's no discussion that can be had. But I think it's that exact argument that you're making with that judge.
Yes, I lost the battle, but won the war. You should never rule against me on that issue again. But
well, there you go.
She was in too far to pull herself back.
Oh, that's funny.
It was a ruling on a preliminary hearing. Mm-hmm. And we both knew that because she was an associate circuit judge at the time, she could dismiss the case. I could just reissue it and it goes to a different judge.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Difference. Although she ended up causing three people to go to trial that would have never gone to trial and got prison time, more prison time than they would have otherwise, because they thought she was right.
Oh.
So one was a... One was really funny trial. Funny for me, not for him. I'll tell this as an aside, just because I think the listener wants to hear it.
Yeah, no, I'm sure.
So one of them was a stealing case out of a Marshall's in South County. The guy had a long record. So it was called a stealing third. So your third stealing offense is a felony. And then you can enhance it if you had a whole bunch of other felonies. And so he was looking at some significant time for essentially what would have otherwise been a misdemeanor stealing. So he's charged with this felony stealing. He's just a career thief. It doesn't matter. If you walk by anything, he's just to steal it. And like the Terminator, he would not stop. He would not have pity or remorse. He would absolutely not stop until he steals whatever it is that's not bolted down. So he's otherwise a fairly pleasant guy.
Yeah.
As far as he interacted with us. But anyway, so he went to Marshall's and he stuck. This is my favorite quote from one of my jury trials. He stuck a pair of shoes down his pants. Like right in the front, like he had baggy pants and he stuck the shoes. So they're on his waistband. He had a big baggy shirt and a jacket. So he put that over the shoes and he's walking out the front. So he walks past the registers and there's like two security people saw him do it, you know? Mm-hmm. So he takes the shoes out, throws them down and runs outside. But under Missouri law, the elements of stealing are if you appropriate somebody's property with the intent to permanently deprive them of that property. And you evidence that, then you're guilty of stealing. So you don't have to get out the doors. Some thieves think I have to take it out the door. So you don't. Once you've concealed on your person, there's case law on it, and you concealed it with the intent to not pay for it later, which he did because he passed the registers, but he didn't leave the store. So he was insisting that he was not guilty because he didn't leave the store. Mm-hmm. So the judge, because she felt bad for this guy, and she had a certain left-leaning philosophy about certain people being charged with felonies that would otherwise be misdemeanors. Anyway, she dismissed it. She discharged it. Well, I got reissued, and at this point, I'm motivated. Mm-hmm. Reissue it. Got him bound over for a trial. He had another hearing, and of course, he lost it because the other judge was like, "Well, the law is clear. You put it on your pants. You can't say you didn't intend to keep it." So we had a jury trial because he was insisting first judge who's now retired was right. And so my closing argument. I said these words.
Oh, no.
Favorite words. Ladies and gentlemen, if we know anything, we know that if a man puts something down his pants, he intends to keep it. The judge is up there, you know, kind of covered his mouth, not to smile. And the bailiff is almost outwardly laughing. Had a couple snickers on the jurors. And they were out deliberating less than 15 minutes, guilty.
Yeah. Oh, that's a good line.
I loved it. I thought that was really great. I'll have to look him up, see if he I'm sure he's out of prison now. He said it's been a long time ago. But there's a couple other guys, too, that she went on a limb for these guys, and they got convinced that she was right. I'm like, well, you know, sometimes the judge is wrong.
Yeah.
Anyway, so what are we talking about?
The argument from language. I want to make another point.
Yeah, the language. Wait, I have other thoughts. Wait, where were they? Go ahead.
But I was going to say, like, with the point on the relativist using very absolute moral language, I think that's something, you know, to give the left at least a little bit of credit for. Is they're very, very good at using language to make people believe that they're 100% right. You're really seeing that now with, I'm sure you saw, but the University of Florida just eliminated all of their DEI positions, like every single one of them. They saved like $5 million for this university by eliminating all of them.
Can you believe $5 million completely down the toilet for however many years that was? Yeah. Every year, $5 million. What are these people doing? Yeah. They were doing nothing. Mm-hmm. I mean, what were they doing?
Yes. But I think the forthcoming decision to remove all those positions, it might have influenced them admitting me into the university as one of the two schools that has admitted me into their grad programs. If I had to guess, but now you're
fired yet? I guess they were just fired, and yes. Now they get, you know, they had 12 weeks severance pay.
Yeah,
they get more jobs like that.
but now you're seeing like everybody's outraged about that, or at least you know a lot of the leftists are. Because it's like, well, now, you know, Jim Crow's going to come back and you guys don't believe in diversity and you don't believe in these moral goods, because the left has gotten so good at saying that, you know, this is inherently a good thing. It is by definition a good thing. And you see there's all kinds of other issues, is that they're very good at using that language to make it a moral good and have no other way about it. And I think that's exactly what you're seeing there.
Yeah, and I'm going off on another aside, but you know, the obvious response to that is Jim Crow can't come back in Florida. The Republicans are in charge. You know, and that's what the Republicans should say. What? Yeah. We're not bringing back Jim Crow. We don't want these Democrats in charge again. What they do, and then that they need to take the gloves off like the Democrats do.
Yeah, you know. That's another point, is that Republican is a bad word. I mean, I see that all the time on campus, is like, oh, you're a Republican. Oh, that means you're a fascist. Oh, that means you hate these people, blah, 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 because they've made the definition of the word into something that's deplorable. And I think they're very good at doing that. And it's not a good thing to be doing, of course, but they're very skilled, I think, at making language in that way.
Yeah, skilled. Satan is very, very clever.
Yes,
you know, evil people are without any morals. Mm-hmm. And moral relativists are always great at misleading people because they don't believe that what they're saying are lies. Mm-hmm. Because the ends justifies the means. That's really the parallel. The two twins. Mm-hmm. The leftist philosophy is, number one is moral relativism or situational ethics, and the other side is the ends justifies the means.
Yeah.
Which is slightly different, you know, because, well, it doesn't matter how much we lied about Kavanaugh. We were trying to keep him off the bench. It doesn't matter how much we lied about Clarence Thomas. We were trying to keep him off the bench. It doesn't, the ends were appropriate, you know. Yeah. It doesn't matter that we lied about mass and 6-foot distancing for whatever reason. So next argument.
Yes.
Which is, what is the next argument? It was a lot of self-contradiction argument, which I think was a lot what they talked about before. He just calls, a relativistic morality illogical logic. Mm-hmm. It's oxymoronic. Mm-hmm. Did you call me a moron? Yes, is what the answer should have been. She makes a counterpoint. Well, why can't morality be gentle instead of hard? You know, free ideals instead of impositions. You know, why suggestions? And he talks about, you know, God, you know, the Ten Commandments being the God's top 10 values. but she says, so you're arguing that absolutism is inherent in the very sense of morality. And of course, he says, yes. You know, but he doesn't really expand on it too much. He talked about Anselm's theory of the existence of God, which is, he mentions that there's a hidden assumption that that is false, that you can even know the true nature of God. But he says you can know the essence of human morality, so therefore it must exist, I guess, mm-hmm. is part of it. You know, I don't know. They spent like half a page on this argument. Yeah. What do you think about that
one? I don't know. It's not enough time, I think, to devote to it. I think his opening argument is better. Back on page 145, he says, my point is that the alternative to absolute morality is not some other kind of morality, any other kind of morality, because there is no other kind of morality, but no morality at all. So if you don't have any absolutes, then it is exactly what the relativist says that they are. It's just feelings or values, you know, conventions, consensus, games, or social approval. So it's like if you don't have any absolute arguments, then the system just is nothing. It's, you know, leaves in the wind. It just immediately blows away. So I think that is somewhat convincing, but I think they get bogged down in the weeds a little bit, or they don't get bogged down enough, I don't think, because they don't go into enough detail to flesh out what he's talking about when he's kind of drawing it to Anselm's ontological argument and stuff like that, and they kind of just gloss over that. I would have liked more time on that, I think, but I think that the general idea is good.
I kind of sense that he probably had 20 pages on St. Anselm's theory.
Yes.
But his editor said, cut all that shit out. And we're like, hey, I'm kind of interested in that. But he just said it's there. And then they went and moved on mm-hmm. to the next article, which is practical self-contradiction, which I thought was, it's not an argument for mm-hmm. absolutely. As much as it is argument against relativism, which I think is a good one, mm-hmm. which is very similar to other arguments we already talked about, which is the fact that relativists act like absolutists when you do them an injustice. They say no fair, and mm-hmm. that's so true. How is that not fair? You know, if you're a relativist, you have to compute whether the other is fair for the other mm-hmm. side. You know, I mean, like, why are you imposing your morality on somebody else? And relativists have a theory of what is right or what is wrong, and they will impose that upon you. Mm-hmm. But they'll say, but yeah, we have to, and that's they're trying to codify it in this hierarchy of victimhood that they mm-hmm. have. They call that intersectionality.
There you go.
Whatever it is, they're trying to codify it. Mm-hmm. So like if I'm a black female lesbian, I'm like a superhero. But if I'm a heterosexual white guy, I'm mm-hmm. screwed, you know, and it's really fascinating. This, you know, it's part of that DEI curriculum.
Mm-hmm.
But they're trying to figure out how to enforce the relativist mm-hmm. moral philosophy. And it's really impossible to do.
Mm-hmm.
And he I like this exchange they had on 147 where he says, would you like to convince us absolutists that relativism is right and absolutism is wrong? And she said, the liberal character says, sure. He says, really right and really wrong? And she says, yes. Then there is a real right and real wrong. But that's what absolutism says.
Mm-hmm.
Like you can't try to convince us we're wrong and you're right. And still say there's moral relativism. Yeah. It's such a simple argument that just kind of goes over their heads.
Yeah.
Like, you have a religion too, dummy.
Mm-hmm.
You just don't have any ordained priests.
Yeah.
They're not ordained
mm-hmm.
or imposed.
Well, I like how they end that discussion there. So after he says there is a real right and wrong, she says, all right, no, then. There is nothing right or wrong, but thinking makes it so. And so then, of course, he responds, then there's nothing wrong with being an absolutist and nothing right with being a relativist. You know, if you really believe in that ideology put forward, you can't prove it. You can't argue in favor of it. You just have to accept what this other person said and go along with it. But of course, you know, they're not going to accept that because they don't actually believe this because it's an impossible thing to think. And I think going back to his earlier argument a little bit earlier, he says, you know, relativists act like absolutists when you do them an injustice. And I think that's very true with the whole, you know, preaching about tolerance, especially what you were talking about earlier. You know, we have to tolerate everybody, everybody's opinions, every religion, everything like that until we don't like them. I think you see that a lot with a lot of these relativists. They're perfectly fine, you know, saying, oh, well, Islam's a beautiful religion. Oh, Judaism's a beautiful religion. Oh, you know, Hinduism's a beautiful religion. But these Christians are trying to ruin our country and enforce their values on us. And it's like, what are you talking about? You can't have it both ways. You can't appreciate everything and then pick out particular enemies out of these groups that you're supposed to tolerate all of them. You know, I think that's exactly the point he's making here, too.
Well, and also, you know, especially with the rainbow crowd, mm-hmm. you know, for Palestine, it's like, wait a second, they'll throw you off a building, dummy. Yeah. I mean, they would literally throw you off a building.
Well, it's that exact thing you're talking about with like the hierarchy of oppression, is that they believe that any of these, you know, quote unquote oppressed groups therefore have the same moral values and have like the same, you know, righteousness in the grand scheme of things. So of course they place, you know, the LGBT on the same level as the Palestinians because they're both being oppressed, you know, the LGBT oppressed by the straight people, the Palestinians oppressed by the Israelis. Therefore, we have to agree. We're on the same side. We're both the oppressed people. And so you have these people, you know, the queers for Palestine is a group out there flying rainbow flags. If they tried that in Palestine, the Palestinians would not have any of that. They just can't wrap their minds around it because they think it's this universal hierarchy that you know, they're brothers in arms.
Yeah, and you got to figure it. And I admit I can't get in the mind of the Palestinians, but they got to be thinking, all right, first we kill the Jews, then we kill these fags. I mean, don't you think that's what they're thinking? But first, the Jews.
Yes.
Then the gays and those men there in those dresses, you know. They're next.
Yeah.
But they're all protesting together. But you, their philosophy, their religion is so against it. And their religion justifies the murder of homosexuals. I mean, the truly devout Muslims. I mean, it's not an aberration that they think that there's capital punishment for homosexual acts. I mean, that's anyway. So, yeah, it's bizarro, you know, but they're trying to codify it, you know, through some sort of filter of oppression. But anyway, back to the book. Sorry about that.
No, it's all right.
Oh, no, that's really offensive that he said that. what was a movie I just watched where it was an English person smoking cigarettes and they used that word, the fag word, but that's what they call cigarettes.
Yes.
Old English movie.
Was it the play that you saw here? Because that happened.
Oh, that's what it was.
Yes.
That's what it was. Eli was like, he's a fag. Yeah, that's right. It was the play. Thank you. I thought it was a movie. I'm like, I don't remember. It's like some sort of goofy story. Yeah. The story was goofy. I will have to say that the actors were very good. Yes. I was very impressed with all the lady actors. That's what you would call them, the female actors,
actresses, I think is the typical word.
Can you say that? I didn't think that. I thought they couldn't.
No,
say
they've tried to remove that. I think now it's just actors, and that's what they did. They did a production of 12 Angry Men, but they changed it to 12 Angry Jurors. That was last semester. Yeah,
probably because they couldn't get any decent male. Well,
that's true. Christ that's sake. True. It was like half women in that one.
Like anyway, but I thought about that storyline. And I'm going to say something offensive.
Okay.
All right. So the storyline is what, five sisters.
Yes.
Five sisters in Ireland in what, the 1930s. So you have five sisters, single sisters in one home with not a father. Right. So the oldest sister's kind of like in charge and some uncle that was a priest who came back from the Africa.
But that's their brother.
That's their brother. That's right.
Yes. The play is Dancing at Lunasa, by the way, for anyone who's curious and wants to look this up themselves.
So what my objection is, and this is where the offensive take is, if you're going to have five sisters, single sisters in Ireland who can't find anybody to marry them, they must be cast as ugly people, okay? You can't have five relatively attractive actresses. Where there's anybody going to believe that these chicks couldn't get a husband for crying out loud. And they like have no hope of ever getting.
I think the reason is one of the sisters had a child out of wedlock. And so they're outcasts.
Bullshit. That's so bullshit. I mean, that was bullshit then. Pardon my language. But, I mean, because one sister had a child out of wedlock, none of the other hot chicks are going to get married. Are you crazy? Even she's going to find somebody. I mean, come on.
It's just really weird. This is a really argument to take on this.
Well, I mean, you didn't see that? It's like this is completely unbelievable that none of these five sisters could get a husband. That was just unbelievable. And then the priest character coming back from Uganda, and he's like, he's gone, literally gone native, right?
Yes.
But he also has some sort of weird, of course, the acting was challenging, I hope that he's a good college kid. I'm sure. I don't mean to be critical because I'm sure he's just, you know, into it and he really tried hard. I don't mean to criticize a college student who's just doing a local play. And he did fine. Mm-hmm. The material was hard. I mean, I think the material for the guys was harder. Yes. But anyway, I didn't understand that entire storyline, you know, because the missions there were pretty successful in converting them to Catholicism, not converting the priest to whatever the Ugandan religion was. That didn't make any sense to me. Oh, it's scandalous. Why isn't he going to say mass? Well, because he'd probably do it in a toga or something. No, that's another, they don't wear togas there. What do they wear there? I don't know what they wear there. I don't know anything about Uganda. My Lord.
There you go. That's
it was such a bizarre play. And the actresses did a great job. And the actors did the male actors did a solid job. Mm-hmm. But the female actresses did very good. So it was entertaining. But the casting was terrible. They should have just had like these ogre women. And they're being believable. Yeah, nobody's going to marry them. And they're hopeless. They're going to starve to death. I mean, that's a science. I mean, if you can't get a job at the factory and you don't have land to raise food, yeah, you're in deep trouble in Ireland.
This rant makes no sense to anyone who has not seen Dancing at Lunasa, the obscure play about an Irish family set in the 1930s. This is such a weird tangent that you've gone on.
I'm pretty sure that our listener is familiar with the material.
Well, yes, that one. We have more than one listener.
Well, that other listener is going to... You probably watch one of these things at YouTube, probably. It's a short play.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's a weird choice of material by the theater department of Truman State University. I'm not sure. I've never heard of it before.
Neither did I.
But thought-provoking. Anyway, back to one of my favorite quotes from the book. Talking about how relativists are really kind of missionaries for their own philosophy. And he says, you know, he says, we're missionaries, but we admit it. And again, the quote here on 148, you are too, though, but you don't admit it. Your relativists preach against preaching. You're on a mission against missionaries. You're missionaries without a religion. You're like the joke about cloning a Jehovah's Witness and a Unitarian together. You get someone who goes door to door to say nothing at all. That's so great. Because a Unitarian has nothing to say about religion. Unitarians. But Jehovah's Witnesses, you got to respect those dudes, man. They go door to door for that religion.
Yeah.
They got stones.
That is true.
And they're absolutists. Aren't they the ones that don't even like Halloween, right? Aren't they?
I don't know.
I think Jehovah's Witnesses, I don't think their kids can go trick-or-treating.
I don't know that.
That's torture. You know, could you imagine trying to convince your kid? No, you can't go trick or treat and get a sack of candy for nothing because God said so. Like, although, you know, when you actually look into Halloween, it's kind of a weird tradition.
Well, I mean, it comes from the Catholics because it's an extension of, you know, All Saints Day.
The popular culture around it.
That's true.
You know, the ghouls and the horror movies and all that kind of stuff. It really is kind of borderline satanic.
That is true. I can see that. Yeah.
Well, that's just, yeah. Anyway. So I don't know if there's anything else to say. I think that's
very good. Well, I do like that quote. I think that's a good place to end because, you know, that's exactly what the relativists say is that they want it to be everywhere. It's exactly what you were talking about earlier with, you know, the whole, you know, codification of these morals, but it's really a moral of nothing, right? It's this idea that, you know, everything's transient and you all have to believe that everything's transient and everything's always changing. And that leaves us with nothing at all. You're just pushing like non-existent values on someone. You're pushing a system that just isn't a system at all. And yet it's everywhere and it's increasingly popular. I think because they're so good at convincing people that it is some sort of absolute truth, even though there's no real meaning behind the words that they say.
Yes.
Yes. All right.
Good summary.
Thank you. Well, do you have any other final thoughts? Do you want to talk about another play? Have you seen any other plays?
No, but I saw Dune 2.
Oh, did you?
With your brother and your mother.
Did you see the first one?
We did a couple of years ago, I guess it was.
Yeah. I want to see that. I haven't seen it yet, so don't spoil it. But
I had to watch like a YouTube summary of part one because I was like, wait a second, I can't remember. Yeah. It was good. It was good. you really have to pay attention. A lot of plots and subplots and this and that.
Well, I know the first one was really slow, but I kind of enjoy that. I like the build up and the fantasy world building and stuff like that. So,
well, there must be a part three, you know.
Well, I'm trying to remember how many books they are, but those two movies are just the first book in the Dune series, and there's like 10 books or something. I don't think they'll do all of them, but they're planning on making a whole bunch of them.
Yeah, I mean, if they keep making money. It was really beautiful. I mean, the cinematography, and I'm not a huge fan of Zendaya, but I think I'm becoming a fan of Zendaya. Mm. I thought she was great in Spider-Man. I've only seen her in Spider-Man, really, and I don't know if I've seen anything else.
Yes,
with her in it, but I thought she was great in that. Yeah. And she does a really solid job in this one. I thought the first movie, she didn't have much of a role.
She only kind of came in at the end, yeah.
And then she's like, oh, this mysterious person. Yes. But she has a much bigger role in this one. Mm-hmm. The Timothy Shyamalan Ding Dong.
He's
really good, the lead guy.
Yeah, so there you go. Well, I guess that's a movie review from us here at Unlimited.
Yeah, you should go see Dune Part 2. Yeah, it's pretty
good. All right. Well, I think with that, unless you have anything else you want to add on to this episode, that has been Season 7, Episode 9 of Unlimited Opinions. I've been Adam Bishop, and you are rubbing your chin as if you're thinking of things to say so we can draw this out even longer.
I'm still Mark Bishop, though.
Well, that was
for better or worse.
Quite an episode.
Well, how did I get on the play?
Because the word for cigarette.
Oh
yes.
Well, you're the one that clued me back into the play. I forgot where I got it from.
Well, yeah.
I blame you.
I don't think I'm to blame for that.
And your mother was unhappy with my theory that I share with Eli. The whole thing I just said to this episode.
Yes.
Yeah. She's like, I don't think you're supposed to talk that way.